And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post Podcast, where we are 12 days from the tip-off of the 2018-19 NBA season. And we must go forward with all of our traditions, and one of them is one of my favorite podcasting traditions. I don't know how many years we've done this, but the great Kevin Arnovitz of ESPN, one of my favorite guests, the original guest of this podcast, this is at least 3 years in a row we have done this. We have each picked our five most confusing teams for the upcoming season, and confusing can mean whatever we want. We are dictators of our own lists. Kevin, how are you?
I'm very good. How are you?
You're very well, as my father would say. Very well.
I am both good and well.
Yeah, he still corrects me on that one. It's really annoying having like a grammarian as a father growing up. And now I'm doing the same thing to my daughter, who's 3.5. She said yesterday someone taked something from her. I was like, honey, somebody took something from you. And then I caught myself. Anyway.
Yeah, my father is just a combination of weird Southern Yiddish hybrid aphorisms. So I don't get any grammar, but I get that other stuff.
That is a good combo. Okay, so we're doing this the same way we've done it before. We've each picked our five teams. We have not told each other what the five teams are. So there will be some surprises, some plot twists, whatever. I am going to start by asking you to reveal your most confusing team, and then we'll riff, and if your first two or three have not appeared on my list, and we'll pivot to my list. Kevin Arnovitz. I guess it doesn't have to be your number one. Kevin Arnovitz, just pick one of your five most confusing teams that you are most excited to talk about.
In really quick caveat, because this kind of happened last year, if I call your team confusing, it doesn't mean that I didn't like what they did in the offseason. It doesn't mean that I don't like them or don't have some faith. It means that there's sort of a great variance in my expectations. Like, it's one of these, you could tell me they'd win 55 games, I wouldn't be surprised. You tell me they, like, don't make the playoffs, I wouldn't be surprised.
And I have even different definitions than that. I have a couple of teams on my list that I'm, like, very sure are going to be really good. I'm just sort of still confused about them for various other reasons. So it can mean anything. So go, number one.
Right. The San Antonio Spurs.
Ah, we overlap right off the bat. Hallelujah. Kevin Arnovitz, why did you pick the San Antonio Spurs?
You know, this is one of those, I'm not sure what it's going to look like. Like, imagine you and I are talking in 2014, and I said, hey, man, like, among the top 100 NBA players, name the least Spursy ones in style and substance. I'm going to guess that LaMarcus Aldridge, DeMar DeRozan, and Rudy Gay would have been in the top five of 100. And right, like, but like, here we are. Here we are. I mean, this is your San Antonio Spurs, players whose individual styles were such a huge departure of what we knew their style was for as long, you know, as long as we can remember. I mean, here's the good news on that. You know, generally speaking, like, if you ask the Spurs, hey, man, like, what are you guys doing in the LaMarcus Aldridge business? Like, what are you doing in the Rudy Gay business? Like, DeMar DeRozan? I mean, they would essentially tell you that, look, it's not really about one particular style, right? Like, what we do is we are a team that can generate better quality looks for players who might be inclined towards iffy shot selection. But it's just like, I don't know what it's going to look like. Am I going to turn on Spurs games and be like, this is absolutely... No, I mean, it's already been a departure, right? I mean, Aldridge being a linchpin of the offense has rendered the 13-14-15 style, I would say, obsolete, but it's certainly, has been masked.
I miss
and
that
shrouded.
Style so much. I miss Boris Diaw already. Boris Diaw is probably on a sailboat somewhere, just sailing around the world.
Coffee machine, yes.
One coach, sure, remained anonymous, was vacationing in Europe this summer and told me that the highlight of his vacation was Boris Diaw calling him and saying, hey, are you in X place on the coast? Yes. Oh, I'm in my boat nearby. Can I just come dock by your house? And like Boris Diaw just showed up at the guy's house.
He's like the nautical vagabond of the NBA, Boris Diaw. Hey, look, it might be really good. I mean, Murray, DeRozan, Gay, Aldridge, Gasol, Poeltl, whoever you have in there. I mean, Murray is already, I think I put him first team all defense last year. I've not seen a pick and roll defender at that position who's bad. I can't even remember. I do worry about him offensively. And look, is there something to the idea that maybe they're not confusing? Maybe they're exactly who I think they're going to be, you know, between 47 and 50 wins. Because this idea that when you add enough competent ball players together, you know, and the team has an inveterate level of discipline, which is what you find in San Antonio, you're just not going to drop much below 45 or 46 wins. Like, it's impossible. They're going to beat crappy teams on a regular basis because they are better prepared, and they are generally disciplined. And, like, this is who they are. I just don't know what it's going to look like. And it's just so fascinating that here we are in 2018 with, like, definitively non-Spursy players who are going to take the bulk of the shots for the San Antonio Spurs.
It is interesting, isn't it? The Spurs were 26th in three-point rate last season. The potential starting lineup that you just named, which I'm not convinced is actually going to be their starting lineup, has zero above-average, high-volume three-point shooters in it. I mean, you could argue Powell is an above-average three-point shooter, but it's not like he's going to be taking five a game.
That's my projected closing lineup, I think.
Could be.
I don't know that it's my projected starting lineup.
They started it in their first preseason game, which, as we know, is means everything. If Minnesota or New York had a shot selection profile like that, which they did, we would all make fun of them. Oh, Tom Thibodeau, this guy hasn't evolved in 10 years, and the Knicks have been stupid for 20 years. The Spurs do it, and we're like, you know, they're getting talented players, and they're putting those guys in positions to succeed, and they're kind of zigging when the league is zagging. Isn't that interesting? Maybe they just have a dumb shot selection. Maybe their shot selection is just dumb. But as you say, okay, they don't foul. They get every defensive rebound. They take care of the ball, and they just discipline and discipline and discipline you to death. And then when they play the Orlando Magic and the Phoenix Suns, they win. I will say this, Kevin Arvitz, I'm down on the Spurs. If Minnesota hadn't become a complete show, I would have picked the Spurs to miss the playoffs. And if the Wolves can somehow salvage this situation, I still might. And that goes against and in batting that around with executives and coaches. Three lines of thinking come back at me every time. Number one, they're the Spurs. They don't miss the playoffs. Okay, fine.
Right.
Not persuasive to me. Number two, well, they won 47 games last year, essentially without Kawhi Leonard.
This is the one I get, which is they're adding DeMar DeRozan to last year's team.
And let me tell you why that's not persuasive to me. Because they also lost Danny Green and Kyle Anderson, who are important parts of their team, and their wing rotation is heavy on guys who are, like, not wings. Like, Rudy Gay is not really a wing anymore. Dante Cunningham's not a wing. And so if you know, Lonnie Walker's a rookie. Bryn Forbes is small. The one guy they're telling me to watch out for is Derek White, by the way. I keep hearing
he was good in Salt Lake. I'm in the Derek White business.
Yeah, I'm getting a lot of Derek White. So, I mean,
I loved him in Salt Lake.
If you consider Rudy Gay a four, and he's not going to play only four, obviously, given the roster construction, you could argue that their second-best proven NBA wing is Marco Bellinelli. It's not good. It's just not good. So that line of thought is not persuasive to me. And the third thing you keep hearing back is, well, they beat all the bad teams. They beat every bad team. I'm like, there are two bad teams in the West now. Two. That's it. Sacramento and Phoenix. And Phoenix appears to think they're good. They're not. Sacramento does not think they're good, according to the whiteboard that may or may not have had their projected record for this season that they accidentally tweeted. How are teams so dumb? I just don't understand how you can be so dumb. The Orlando Magic just did this a year and a half ago. You would think everyone would have their whiteboard on lockdown when anyone with a camera phone or anyone with the phone is, I just don't understand. So, on the flip side, they did win 47 games. They actually had the seventh best net rating in the league last year and the fourth best defense. So there are, I get why people are like, you're crazy to predict the Spurs miss the playoffs. I just kind of don't love their team in terms of its construction and its lack of shooting. And, you know, and that said, they're wildly optimistic about DeJounte Murray. And the Spurs are not the kind of team that gets wildly optimistic in September and October and verbalizes it. They're verbalizing it about Murray and his jump shot being remade and all this. I don't feel great. Don't feel great about the team.
Yeah, I mean, I do that very simplistic thing, but tends to work when evaluating the prospects of a team, which is like, I don't think they're going to be any worse than 8 or 9 defensively. And so, okay, you tread water offensively. They were not a good offensive team last year. And might not be much better this year, though. I mean, Murray obviously is the variable, but as you said, they have kind of a vintage Grizzlies-esque wing rotation where there's just nobody at the 2 or 3 with the necessary combination of size and stretch and versatility. But I just, I kind of put my faith in that. But yeah, you made me realize, right? Like the hey, we're just adding DeMar to last year's team isn't entirely accurate. And like long wings matter. Like long wings matter. And we've sort of, it's funny, we've taken all the threes in the league and we've made them fours. So there really truly isn't any such thing as a small forward. A small forward is a shooting guard who doesn't shoot all that well, right? Or like if you're a really capable three in the league, which means, oh, and you have really good size, you're a four. And so, you know, and twos and ones are sort of this kind of like the three now is sort of this odd position. And like Kawhi is sort of, and hey, even Kawhi, right? Like we're probably going to see him play a fair amount of four. Like there are no threes anymore. So you now need twos with really good size. It's a really, I was trying to think of sort of the small four. It was funny on that NBA GM survey that's been circulating that John Schumer does every year, does a great job, is just how like conflated the positions were. Like LeBron was voted as a power forward and a small forward.
KD was voted as like everything, basically.
Yeah, AD was voted as everything. So it's funny, like it is actually harder to get a strong 2-3 wing rotation these days. I mean, what generally happens is you get a couple of ones, a two masquerading as a three, and is that even problematic? Who knows?
That's why Toronto, who is not on my list, is so interesting to me because, you know, I get a little queasy about their big man rotation without Poeltl, who I think is a solid backup center who could start eventually on an okay team. Because Valanciunas, we know, will have matchup problems against certain teams. Ibaka looked like he was in cement by the time the playoffs started. Greg Monroe, ditto. And Siakam, I do really like and can play against any team. But then you look at their guards, and it's like, I mean, even their point guard rotation, Van Vliet, Lowry, and DeLon Wright can play the two. And then they're loaded with these Anunobis, Green, Leonard, Miles. I mean, just on and on and on. Utah.
Kawhi's going to be. Don't you think Kawhi will be finishing as a four? I mean, and this is why I'm really bullish on Toronto. I just like what you can do.
Yeah, I am too. Maybe we'll get to Toronto later. Maybe we won't. Spurs thing for me. They seemed to coalesce last year around an identity of LaMarcus Aldridge at center. They were plus +8 per 100 possessions when he played without Powell or King Geoffrey Laverne. And LaMarcus and Powell were like plus +3.5. I'm fascinated to see sort of if they start that way. So if you pencil in DeJounte, DeMar, and LaMarcus as three of the five starters, if LaMarcus is starting at center, who are the other two players? One might be Davis Bertans. Who's the other one? Is it Bellinelli? Is it someone we don't expect? I have no idea. But I liked the way their team looked better with LaMarcus at center. Also going that route turns Poeltl into like essentially a third string center. How do they get minutes for him? And if they do start Powell, who's the fifth guy? Is it Rudy Gay? And then you have that non-shooting. Is it an unidentified wing that we don't know about? Is it Bertans and you just sort of figure it out? I don't think that's the case. I just think it's interesting. Interesting question.
Right. I mean, this points to your problem. They don't have anybody with the sort of with perimeter stretch and size. You know, they could throw Lonnie Walker in the deep end.
You never know.
I mean, that could be something they do. I have no idea. And I say that with no informed, you know, knowledge.
They have discussed how some of the coaches on the staff prefer Rudy to come off the bench because they like the idea of similar to how Manu came off the bench. Like, well, what, let's not put all our scorers in right off the bat. Let's save one for the bench. But that brings up interesting questions too. Interesting team. I think I will pick them to make the playoffs, assuming Minnesota trades Jimmy Butler and loses the trade. Anything else on the Spurs?
Nah.
Kevin Arnovitz, your second confusing team for the 2018-19 NBA season.
Oh, so we're not alternating. I'm going to go again. Oh,
you're going.
We overlapped, right?
Yeah, we overlapped. You're going again.
The Memphis Grizzlies.
Not on my list. Okay. Tell me why you picked the Memphis Grizzlies.
Okay, so I feel like for years we've all worked under the assumption that if Conley and Gasol are healthy, there's a floor to the Grizzlies, right? Like, they're just not going to be a bad team. You know, they're both excellent defenders. They're efficient offensive players. And so now, but now what we're seeing is a bunch of projections that have them in the 30s, in the low mid 30s, no less. So the question is this, like, it was last year, like the 2007, 2008, like Miami Heat. Like, remember, they were decent the year before. It was, you know, Riley's last year. They temporarily, not even tanked, it just becomes a disaster. I think that year that, you know, they take Shaq for Sean Marion. Wade misses, you know, the last few months of the season. And then, oh, by the way, they're back to being kind of the 46, 47 win team the next year under Spoelstra. Right, like, is, or it was last year just kind of a temporary departure from a team that we know to be pretty good. You know, a solid, you know, 5-8 seed, and that kind of rests itself on the competence of those two guys. You know, you get Kyle Anderson, nice acquisition. They got him at market value. It wasn't a steal. They got a nice player at a nice price.
Yeah, there's a lot of hate on that contract, and like, I think Slo-Mo is kind of good. We can talk about his fit on this team. It looks tailor-made in some ways, and in other ways, not so much. He's 20. People hate the four-year deals for role players. It's just a universally hated contract. And I get why that is, but it's below the league's average salary by a hair, I think. And he's just turned 25 2 weeks ago, so it's going to get him for all of his prop. Like, I don't have any strong objection to that deal, and I'm surprised by how many people do.
Yeah, and that's my fun thing, too. Look, like, in a league where the cap is over $100 million, you're paying nine and a half, you know, to a guy who's going to give you, you know, 28 productive minutes, maybe more, maybe a little less, who seems durable. Like, I just don't understand the hate. Like, so you overpaid him by $1 million a year, $3 million a year? I mean, I know it's 4 years, but, I mean, what is nine and a half going to look like on the books, you know, when the cap is wherever it is in 4 years? Like, again, I'm with you. Like, I've heard a lot of pushback. And you could say he's not the answer for them, okay? But it just seems like a relatively moderate risk deal. And I know it's wrong. I think that's one of those chestnuts that you don't give role players long-term deals, that we just kind of, it's kind of become absorbed in the general lore of the league. But like, when you actually break down the logic, it's like, yeah, sometimes. But there's no, I don't think it's a hard and fast rule. So, you know, like, look, he could be a 36-37% three-point shooter. They haven't had a skill set on the wing. They haven't had anybody on the wing basically ever who's healthy and can actually move the ball and provide, you know, any modicum. I mean, the Memphis Grizzlies wing situation for years has just been, I mean, it's essentially what prevented them from being an elite team.
Not long ago, my friend, they were starting playoff games with Tony Allen and Tayshaun Prince with a combined range of 35 feet, well, actually less than that, down on their jump shots.
And Pondexter coming off the bench. I mean, it's been a sore point. By the way, I'm a fan of Jaren Jackson Jr.
Everybody is.
There's length, range. Rookies are rarely plus players, so I'm not gonna suggest that he is going to, you know, win them basketball games. I don't think he's going to hurt them. Jermichael Green's in a contract year. I mean, I know you're a Wayne Selden guy. You know, not healthy enough for me to observe last year. I do know you've liked him. I don't see a terribly creative player, but I see a reasonably solid one. He made some really nice passes in Salt Lake. He actually, you know, shoots pretty well off the dribble. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I don't.
You
I don't
really, you answer. Really loved Salt Lake Summer League. I think you're all in on Salt Lake Summer League now.
I am. It's the. I don't want to say anything more because I don't want anyone there.
Oh, sorry. Well, we're not going to edit this out of the podcast. I'm not going. I'm going to keep going to Vegas.
Okay. Yeah, I know. It's just, I just, you know, it's actually wonderful. Like, you, it's just like three of us there. Like, it's, anyway, I'm not going to say anymore. You know, I can't tell you anything he does poorly. I can't tell you anything he does exceptionally well. But you see them here in the low 30s on the sort of win total, you know, over under. And that just seems really low. I mean, I know injuries, but, you know, so is the low 30s essentially the idea that, look, basic empirical thinking in Memphis is somebody will get hurt, one of those two guys, and this team doesn't have the sufficient depth to absorb that, and the West is really tough. But if you just go back to, okay, healthy Conley and Gasol with these various other, you know, Parsons looks, I don't know, he looks okay. I mean, it's just, they're not terrible. Like, 33 wins is terrible. They're not terrible. But maybe I'm missing something here. I mean, I do believe kind of in convention.
I don't think 33 wins in the West is terrible. I think it's just bleh. When the dust settled around July 15th, in my head, I was with you, and I was like, well, I think I might call for Memphis as a playoff team. I think that might be my, like, out-of-the-box call. And then I sat down, and I did, like, a roster reset of every team and their cap situations and all that. And I just – I don't see it. And part of it is that Mark and Mike are a year older. Mark is 33, I think, now. Mark's older than people think. Also kind of in a contract year, has a very interesting player option for next season. Mike is coming off this mysterious heel thing that somehow lasted essentially an entire season. Now, maybe that wouldn't have been the case had Memphis had anything to play for. And I like, and the thing that did it for me is, like, I like all these wings fine. Like, I just had a Shlomo spiel. Temple's fine. Seldon, you know, I like Seldon a little bit.
You know what, Shlomo, we do need a player in the league named Shlomo. That would be much
Dylan Brooks had a nice solid rookie year. And then you look at their usage rates. Like, Shlomo, 13%. Garrett Temple, 16% on a terrible Kings team. Dylan Brooks is, you know, something in the teens. These are guys that just don't have track records of, like, doing anything. And either they're going to have to do a lot more stuff in terms of finishing possessions and creating, or the load on Mark and Mike is going to be just so big that I'm not sure at this stage in their careers they can bear it. Now, we haven't talked about Chandler Parsons, who for the fourth straight year allegedly looks good and is going to make a comeback. I'll believe it when I see it.
Right.
But I just kind of don't see enough juice around those guys. If they were 27 and in their absolute primes and you told me they could prop up these kind of limited role players, spot up guys, cutters, whatever, to 46 wins, I would have said, okay, I can see that. I can't see it anymore.
That's fair. I mean, you know, my imagination is sort of frozen in 2014 Grizzly Land, which is one of my favorite places ever. I love that Grizzlies team. I mean, I just really did. You know, that's that thing that happens with distance where, you know, I just love that sort of halcyon Grizzlies team. I will miss it.
We all like that team. Okay, so the rule is going to be you have to go two straight without being on my list before we pivot to my list. So we're going back to you. Unless you have any other Grizzlies things to say?
No. I mean, you've sort of convinced me that my confusion is rooted in.
No, I don't know. What do I know? I don't know. Yeah. I'm just my opinion. I don't see it, but I didn't see a lot of things. Listeners, I would imagine that hiring someone is a huge pain. How do you find candidates? Where do you post your job? There are a million job posting sites. It all seems like a dumb way to waste a lot of time. But you know something that is smart? Going to ZipRecruiter.com to hire the right person. It doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. It has powerful matching technology that scans thousands of resumes, identifies people with the right skills and education and experience and all that good stuff, and actively invites them to apply. It also has technology that, like, highlights good candidates that you might miss. It does all of the legwork, all of the sorting, all the stuff that used to take hours, does it all for you. That's why it's rated number one by employers in the U.S. That rating comes from hiring sites on Trustpilot with over 1,000 reviews. And right now, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free. Literally, that costs you nothing. And you go to this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/lowpost, all one word. That's the name of this podcast, ZipRecruiter.com/lowpost, L-O-W-E, post. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Kevin Arnovitz, your third most confusing team for the 18-19 NBA season.
The Indiana Pacers.
Not on my list either. That means we get to pivot to my list next. I'm very excited. But tell me why you picked the Pacers. Good. Tell me why you picked the Pacers.
Okay, so they clearly overachieved. And I'm just, like, contemplating for a second that a team with a starting point guard platoon of Collison and Joseph, a team like Thad Young led in minutes, you know, a team where Miles Turner never really got healthy for long stretches, where the key floor spacer was Bogdanovich. And even with maximum output from Oladipo, and obviously that was the variable, you know, how does that team win, like, well over half of their games? So, and the answer is they just play their asses off, and, you know, they have a decent pick-and-roll attack, and they have really smart situational coverages. You know, I was sort of – I was always – it was one of those teams where, you know, you tune in at 4 o'clock Pacific on a – on a tooth, and I, you know, here they are tipping off against, you know, whoever it is in the East, and it's just like, all right, I'm going to see how many, you know, one of the things I do in the first quarter is like, all right, how many mistakes can I watch them make defensively in the first 8 minutes? And it's like, you know, you just, time goes on, they just don't make any mistakes. And, you know, I don't think of it as a particularly heady, you know, high IQ team. I mean, you know, Young and this guy, I mean, whatever, but they just kind of were really disciplined. And, you know, they have decent positional size, except with Collison, and you could see that materialize. Like, oh, it's really nice to be a big team, to have really good size and length at every position, you know, except with Collison's on the floor. So I feel like I'm still right to call it overachievement. But if it was overachievement, is it sustainable? Is Oladipo one of the 15 or 20 best players in the world? Are we certain of that now? If Turner is who we think he is, what he might be able to be, and he can provide spacing and continue to improve as a, you know, as a pick and roll partner, and he's already pretty damn good at that for a young guy. And you can get all those new, you know, ball handlers on the floor at the same time. You know, have Joseph, Oladipo, and Tyreek. You know, I love that sort of, hey, your 1 through 3 guys are all essentially creators. You know, maybe this is a consistent upper 40 win team. I'm still having trouble buying it. And again, it's not because, you know, I don't believe in the effort or anything else. I mean, there's a reason they were projected in the, you know, in the 20s last year. And the, you know, the roster, you know, it wasn't like they picked up any great acquisition. In fact, they lost Turner. And so I'm just wondering, is this for real? Is that a 1 year blip where everything kind of fell into place? Everybody bought in. Or is this like, hey, this is a making of what, this is what a number 4 or 5 seed looks like. I don't know.
Kevin Arnovitz, just another Coastal Elite hating on flyover country. That's all, you know. I bet if I made 100 NBA insiders make their 5 most confusing teams list, Indiana would appear on half of them and be the most commonly selected team that's not the Lakers, because everyone is confused about the Lakers. I hear everything you just said. I've heard versions of that from lots of people, and I get it. They were the hardest playing team in the league last year.
Totally.
They are not catching anybody by surprise this year with their effort or their talent, and they did catch people by surprise last year. It's not happening again. And we have seen examples of these kind of teams where they overachieve and everybody assumes sort of linear improvement from there, and that's just not how basketball works. It's not how the NBA works, and so they slide back 4 or 5 wins, and everyone says, oh my God, what a disappointment. They went from 48 last year, the feel-good story of the year, to 44 this year and missed the playoffs. But really, they sort of found their true water level. I actually think the Pacers are just a good team. And by that I mean, and this is why they didn't make my list, I don't think they're going to fall very far back, if at all. But I also don't think they're going to go from like 48 to 52, 53, just because that's, again, the linear progression that one would allegedly expect to make. But I think this is a legitimate 47, 48 win team that has talent that first of all, they do strike me as a group that will continue to play hard. They are not, I don't think they're going to let up what made them special last year. They're young, so a lot of their key guys will get better. I like Tyreek Evans for them. Tyreek Evans, by the way, you know, really 3 straight years of really good 3-point shooting. And if you look at his numbers, he shoots just as well off the dribble as he does off the catch, which is very unusual. Around 40, you know, both ways for 3 straight years. I don't think anyone saw that coming 5 years ago from Tyreek Evans. Like, serious kudos to him. He remade his jump shot. I think he's now just a legitimately good 3-point shooter. And if you put that kind of player next to Oladipo, a guy who can shoot like that and also relieve some pressure from him. Remember, Cleveland just was like, we're just going to put 3 guys on Oladipo because we don't care about anyone else. Well, now they've got someone else over there who can do that. I like their versatility. They can play big. They can play small with McBuckets at power forward or something like that. And they can play with no point guard at all. Like the guys you just mentioned, Collison, Kojo, Aaron Holiday, they don't know how to play. You can play Oladipo, Tyreek Evans, 2 wings and a big, or a wing and 2 bigs. I just like the depth and versatility. So I'm in on the Indiana Pacers as a not confusing 48 win team. That's the end of my long-winded rant. Not even a rant.
And I'm kind of rude. I mean, I'm generally rooting for them. I mean, I'd like to see them maintain or possibly get better. It's just this is maybe residual confusion. Like, they confused me last year. It surprised me. It's just like, if you told me, yeah, and by the way, Turner's going to get hurt and he's not going to give you much, and I'm like, oh, this is literally quite possibly a lottery, you know, high lottery team. And I think so. Maybe this is residual confusion. Maybe I know exactly who they are, which is, yeah, they're going to win probably maybe roughly the same games they won last year. And I do like that Evans. It's funny because I was out on Evans early.
Sacramento
drafted him to be their point guard. I just was like, I'm sorry, that is an experiment that is going to fail promptly. I've come way, way, way back on Evans.
I think Indiana is going to be solid. That's the end of my Indiana take. I think they're going to be solid, and I think Turner is going to make not a leap, but is going to make the sort of big stride that everybody wanted last year and didn't happen. He's in much better shape. He says, and we'll see how it translates, that he's worked all summer on his footwork defensively and containing the pick and roll while, you know, remaining on balance and being able to guard kind of two guys at once, like stuff that he just has been fundamentally unsound at since he came in the league. I think he should shoot more threes. He and I talked a couple weeks ago. He does not seem super into shooting more threes. He just kind of wants to shoot 40%. If that's what he cares about, I'd just like to see him shoot more threes. But I think he'll have a demonstrably better season. So anyway, that's the Pacers.
That was my pick on five. Like which of the NBA rank, like which player do you expect to make one of the bigger leaps? And Turner was my choice. I think he is going to have a really big year.
Now we get to go to my list.
Yeah.
And we just did Spurs, Grizzlies, and Pacers, which means it's time to go to a big market team. And I have a couple of them on my list, and I'm tempted to choose one, but I'm going to choose the other. Kevin Arnovitz on my list for the most confusing teams of 2018-19 NBA season, the Los Angeles Lakers. It must be talked about. They must be talked about. They've played two preseason games already. They have a bizarro roster construction of misfits and young guys and 2.5 centers, one of whom is a rookie who's injured. Tim Bontemps just came out with a piece today in the Washington Post predicting that they missed the playoffs, which is not an uncommon prediction when you lob the Lakers at executives and coaches around the league. They are on my list. Did they make your list?
No.
Wow.
And it's not that I'm not confused. I find like 23 of the 30 teams confusing. So I mean, this is actually just
interesting. I had a harder time this year finding confusing teams.
They are confusing. In the sense that I don't know what it's going to look like, and I mean, where's the shooting going to come from? And not to be reductive, and like that's the only thing that matters. And look, you have LeBron James and. You know, these guys with like 17 eyes with great vision, and I get all that. I just, at some point, somebody has to shoot a ball from 24 feet at the end of a shot clock or you know, when the defense overloads, you know, the strong side pick and roll. Like, who makes those shots? I mean, is there a high volume 38% 3-point shooter on that team?
JaVale's been working on his jumper. I actually. Weirdly, I'm not worried about that with the Lakers. And I guess part of the reason that I'm the main reason I'm optimistic about the Lakers is because LeBron's on their team. The other reason I'm optimistic about the Lakers is all the attention's been paid to the veterans. And why did they sign these guys? They can't shoot. They don't make any sense. They're playmakers. LeBron's a playmaker. Blah, blah, Lance is crazy. Michael Beasley. What? How? Nah. I think their young guys are good. Like, I think their young guys are better than those veterans. And part of what makes their team confusing and interesting to me is sort of like, how quickly are they going to come to the realization that like Hart, Kuzma, Ingram should all play more than the veterans that they signed? I like KCP as he's sort of like a tailor-made. He's never been as good a shooter as people think. Like he looks like a good shooter and he's just an okay one. But you know, as a defense first spot up guy, like he fits what you need around LeBron. Those guys are all better than the veterans they signed that's what's interesting to me is like, when do they realize that? And of course, the epitome of that is Lonzo versus Rondo. And even like these bad shooters. So Michael Beasley in his last two seasons, 52 of 129 from three. That's 40%. Very low volume. He does not like to shoot threes. He likes to take his little step in and take a 21 footer with his heel on the line and make me puke. Can shoot okay from three if he's open. Rondo catch and shoot threes the last 3 years. 32%, but 34.5% when he's wide open. 40% the next year, 43.5% when he's wide open. 37% both ways the year before. I might have mixed up the years there, but those are the last three. Like, that's okay. I understand that on the possessions that he doesn't shoot or get the ball, or get an assist, his lack of shooting is doing sort of like harder to see negative damage to their offense. But like, even Lonzo, 33.7% on catch and shoot threes last year, and he took a lot. Interestingly about Lonzo, I just gave you the catch and shoot figure, 33.7. 32% after one dribble and something similar after two dribbles. That's like kind of encouraging that he took daring threes and shot like in the low to in the low 30s. Like it's not like he took only the Rondo threes and made 33%. So I look, Lance can't shoot anymore and Rondo is blah and I get it, but I'll tell you this. I'm much more worried about their defense than I am about their shooting.
Interesting. I'm a huge, I'm on the Ingram bandwagon. I mean, this is a kid who is essentially a straight line drive, you know, dribble attack guy who who expanded his field for the game last year incredibly. I think he's a fantastic player.
If you gave me over under 1.5 all-stars that he makes in his career, I'm taking the over. 2.5, I'm starting to think about it a little bit. I mean, 3 all-stars is a lot. It doesn't sound like a lot, but that's like you were a really good player for a long time, particularly in the Western Conference, to make 3. 1.5,
I think he's going to be a really good player for a long time.
Okay.
I'm with you. You know, it's funny. they actually rated reasonably well defensively last year. I don't know what it again. I don't know what it looks like. I am genuinely confused by them.
I'm unconvinced, and I think it was they were like top 5 for the first couple of months, and then kind of fell off after that. I think there was some flukiness involved in that.
Yeah. No. And by the way, Lonzo very quietly had a really decent shooting second half of the season when he was well. You know, it's funny. He got tarred early on because whether it was the mechanics. Obviously, he didn't shoot proficiently. Period. So. But he shot extremely well the second half of the season. It is funny. Will we see a situation where anybody? What circumstances, in your opinion, will dictate? Okay, you know what? We're actually going to run the young guys out there with LeBron.
Well, I just think it's as simple as like we now know in the NBA, it's really hard even with LeBron on your team. We just saw this with Wade and Derrick Rose last year. Remember they started those guys for like a week and we're like, oh, this is obviously a terrible idea, like everyone said it was. It's hard to win when you have more than one non-shooter in the lineup and really hard to win when there are two. The two is doable if you have LeBron and the other two guys are really good shooters. Other than that, you just can't. So like, I just think it's a matter of like, you just got to choose very carefully who plays with who, and it shouldn't be that hard.
Fair enough. Do we think Kuzma's a great shooter? We think he's a good shooter.
I think Kuzma's a good shooter, and he took – I mean, I talked about daring looks for Lonzo. Kyle took some hoggy looks last year. I mean, that dude loves to shoot, and if he gets a cleaner palette of looks, I think he'll shoot. If he told me he shoots 40% from three this year, I wouldn't be blown away. I think he's a solid shooter.
Well, then there you go. There's my high-volume –
what did he shoot last year? I bet he shot worse. What do you think Kuzma shot from
36.6% on 5.6 attempts in 31 minutes. So, yeah, that's a lot of shots.
Yeah, the defense is what worries me, and I think it's a lock that at some point in the season they will bring in another big man because you can't count on the kid from Michigan who's already hurt. You can't count on my boy Zubats.
And Kuzma's just not a rim protector.
Yeah, those lineups are going to be offense lineups with Kuzma or Braun at Pickham at center. Those lineups are going to score 118 points per 100 possessions and give up 115, and that's how they're going to win.
Listening to you just reminds me. Do you remember like as recently as 7 years ago with the big trade deadline, like chatter for any aspirational team who wants to win a title? Like we need another big man. Like we got to bring Eric Dampier in here. Like, you know, it, that was a thing, right? Like teams would look around and say, oh, like our big man rotation just doesn't have enough. You know, we're only 3 deep. Like let's go get a body. Let's go get Ivoskas. Let's go get Eric Dampier. Like that used to be a big thing and now it's just not any, like hearing you say it, it was just nostalgic. You know, a team with title hopes looks up in January and says, oh, we need a rim protector. We desperately need a 5 in here, a pure 5. Like, that just does not get set anymore.
I think they'll get one. I mean, you know, There was an interesting debate on Twitter last night about who's going to have a better season, JaVale McGee or Brook Lopez. And because Brook Lopez was, you know, stretching to the corner and taking trail threes, and the Bucks beat the Bulls, who look like absolute dog poop, by 9,000 points. I said all summer, like as of July 2nd, I don't understand why the Lakers just didn't bring back Brook Lopez, a stretch five next to LeBron. That like makes a lot of sense. And there was some argument last night about, well, you know, JaVale's a pick and roll threat. He's a lob threat. Look, we did it for the Warriors last year. He's a better defense player. He's a rim protector. I get all of that. He just doesn't play minutes. Like JaVale just tops out at 12, 13, 14, 20, 12, 11 minutes. And especially if you're going to run like the Lakers want to run, I just think you'd get more raw production from Lopez, who can play 30. If you need him to.
But does it solve your problem defensively? That's the question. Like, I'm
no,
not gonna say,
but I don't think either one defender.
Look, maybe they would get Rolo. I mean, he'll be available.
Yeah. Maybe, that would be great. Have both the twins.
I like that. Let's
replace
that.
One
Robin
twin with
Lopez
the other.
To the Lakers.
I think the Lakers are going to be I don't know what the over-under ended up at. I would take the over a little bit. I think the Lakers are going to be good. Do you want to do my list or your list next?
Let's keep with you. I'm enjoying.
Okay, so I think this one might surprise you. And this is where I'm stretching the definition of confusing almost to its limit, because I'm not actually like worried about this team or that confused about this team, but I'm a little bit confused. The Philadelphia 76ers.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I've just had this gnawing feeling in my gut all summer that they're not going to be as good as we expect. And I can't explain why, other than the very stupidest and most superficial reasons, which is that they lost these shooters who sort of ignited their, you know, crazy stretch run, Bellinelli and Ilyasova. And that makes me a little nervous. And then they didn't get Bielitsa, who bailed on them to go to the Kings. What's with all these players bailing on teams to go to the Kings? Yogi Ferrell did it too. The Vlad father can't resist the Vlad father. And you know, their bench, I think their bench is going to be okay. Wilson Chandler will get hurt. Amir Johnson is kind of can't play anymore. TJ McConnell's fine for what he is. I like Muscala. Like I'm not super confident in the bench, but it's all right. Obviously, and what's weird about feeling a little cautious about them is that they have two superstars who are ages 24 and 22 or something like that, and players of that age range tend to just get better. I mean, that is where you do see linear progress. I just – something makes me a little uneasy, and I think it is the very logical and understandable move away from a starting lineup that was like plus 20 per 100 possessions and throwing Fultz in.
21-4.
Yeah.
By the way, I just turned in, and it'll be a – might as well promote it now. I did the Sixers feature for the magazine, which should be published probably the week the season starts. And I address exactly this. Like, this team that has relied on, you know, empirical data and kind of good decision-making is basically saying, we have the best lineup in basketball, and we're going to break it up voluntarily. Not because a guy left, not because, you know, we brought in somebody else and we upgraded, and yeah, we know that that lineup is good, but how do you not put that guy in? I mean, it's just because we believe in the future, and Markelle Fultz is part of that.
Well, and I also think, and I'm sure your story gets into this, that there is some of, we've got to nurse this guy back to confidence. And a way to do that is, hey, man, you're our starting one. That's it. We need you. You're a core part of the team. Maybe that's not in your story. I would imagine that is
thinking. Exactly. That is it. Like when they see confetti falling in Philadelphia in the next 5 years, you know, it is a big three, or at least, you know, a very strong 2.7. Okay. And Fultz is part of that equation. I mean, I hear your concern. I'm always a little reluctant to allow, hey, they kind of, I'm not sure about their seventh and eighth men be the cause for concern for any team. I hear you on Bellinelli and Ilyasova. That is kind of when they really caught fire last season. I think Redick off the bench might more than compensate for the Bellinelli thing. And I'm a Muskie guy. I like Muscala. I think Muscala is going to give lot of what Ilyasova gives you.
That sentence can work in a couple of different ways.
I'm trying to think of the
I'm a Muskie guy. You have a strong Musk about you. I don't know that you do. I'm just, I'm a musky guy too in terms of in basketball terms.
I'm generally a fragrance-free, dye-free, free kind of product consumer, but I hear you. I just don't worry. And again, as you said, like, look, are your best players getting younger or getting older? Which again is a pretty simplistic, reductive way of looking at it. But obviously, their best players are getting older. I mean, Ben Simmons is going to be better.
If we can find someone who someone whose best player is getting younger, then we're really onto something. If the Lakers can figure out how to make LeBron younger in the next couple of years, I don't mean worried. I just mean like what's their over under? It's got to be 56, 55. I don't know.
I think it was like 54. Where are those?
Okay. Then maybe I'm not.
Don't you have like the Jimmy Shapiro email? Isn't that
I've got so many. I've got so many.
I
guess I'm just not ready to go from whatever they were last year to 58, 59. And that seems pessimistic. Maybe it's not. Maybe that's what the consensus is.
Philly is at, let's see, in one of these 53.5. And as current, 54 now. Yeah.
Okay. So maybe I'm right with Vegas. They do have other low hanging fruit. They had the second worst foul rate in the league last year behind Memphis, which means their opponents shot, second most free throws per shot attempt, and they led the league in turnovers. That's just sort of, again, I think we'll see how those things trend with Markel in the starting lineup. By the way, all the attention paid to Markel Fultz's shooting, justifiably, he's huge for his position. And that starting
– love him defensively.
That they have a chance to be the best defense in the league. I mean, that – Fultz, Covington, Embiid, and Simmons in the starting lineup is ridiculous.
No, it's that length we talked about with Milwaukee's lineup like last year when that was – I was very into that. Like, hey, you stretch them across the length of the floor and you essentially have it blanketed, and they are that team. I mean, Fultz rates – it's funny when you talk to – and look, I realize there's always a message going on, and you're deflecting concern about his shot and his confidence. But, like, they earnestly think that, like, he is defensively – all-NBA material, not in season one necessarily, but that just the profile, the versatility. I think he's a much smarter player than people were. None of us have really seen him.
I guess.
And it's not like, and anyone who says they're watching University of Washington basketball games in 2016 is lying. I mean, maybe you are. Kevin Pelton is not lying.
I didn't watch any.
I did not either.
I guess what it comes down to is I feel like a lot of these other teams just sort of makes sense right off the bat. Now, Boston, I think it's been revealed in the preseason, has more kinks to work out than was anticipated. Milwaukee is just Giannis and four shooters, boom, go. Makes sense. Toronto makes sense, all the wings we just talked about. Philly, I just feel like we gotta feel out these two dudes. Now, it looks like Fultz is gonna shoot threes. He shot four the other night. But like these two guys in Simmons and Fultz who like are three phobic last year, and Embiid, who's he's not a traditional center. He's not a traditional anything. He's Joel Embiid, but he wants to be around the rim and bang and all this. I just feel like there's just more stuff, more angst, more things to feel out that I'd be comfortable with. If I thought, 58, 59, 60 wins, I guess that's really all. And also, like, by the way, this could be a very forward thinking decision. It doesn't have to be, catering to what Markel Fultz wants. It could be a very forward-thinking decision in that, like, they as an organization could look at what happened in the Boston series and say, hey, look, we reached the limits of what this offense can do with running the fewest pick and rolls in the entire league and many fewer in the playoffs than they did in the regular season, and having all these handoffs and guys flying off screens. Like, we got in front of an elite defense and we could not score anymore. And we just need now, right now, to start building a different sort of offense. We're going to keep elements of that other thing, but we're going to need to start building a different kind of offense with a different kind of ball handler like that. And again, remember they started TJ McConnell for that reason in the last two games of that Boston series. It is very forward thinking in that way.
Yeah. I mean, I question myself sometimes. I mean, because I love lineup data. It tells us a lot. I mean, you can talk about 18, but what we're talking about are five individuals on the floor, and I rely on it. And I will often, in second spectrum, just kind of watch a lineup, 100 possessions, 200 possessions. And sometimes I think I rely on it too much. I mean, there's nothing preventing. I mean, Like, Brett Brown is a good problem solver, right? Like, it might be that on a given night, guess what? You know, Cub isn't giving you anything offensively. You love his defense, but the matchup warrants something else because he's actually, you know, the assignment isn't that important. And you're going to have nights where, I mean, they're going to have essentially Fultz and Reddick in the backcourt with Simmons effectively playing the Covington position. Maybe Dario and Embiid are still out there. Like you can do a lot of different things. I mean, I think sometimes I psych myself out analytically with, okay, this lineup. And, you know, the other thing that I would love to, and, you know, ask some of our analytics guys and our stats and info guys is, like, you know, how transferable are lineups over time? I mean, is a lineup, do the top three lineups in 15-16 pour over to 16-17? I mean, it's a question, you know, I think a lot of us get really fixated on, hey, this lineup was just, you know, killer. And obviously in the case of the Warriors, I mean, it is sustainable. It has been sustainable. Although even, I mean, we did find that, you know, actually, you know, there was a period where kind of the lineup of death fell off to a certain extent. But, like, I mean, that's always what I'm wondering is like, how sustainable is the dominance of any given five-man unit year to year?
Well, I think
aren't individuals.
I think you can even zoom out. And this is one of the more interesting questions that I've tried to tackle in little isolated ways, and I would like to tackle at some point in a macro way, which is, like, the sort of, you know, we tend to think, and there is, value in continuity, right? Like, oh, they're carried over their whole team. They know how to play. They're going to come out in the first 20 games with, like, a giant head start on all these other teams who changed half their roster. And then I have come to believe that there is a flip side and a staleness that comes with playing the same way every year, that the league begins to catch up, that your actions become too predictable, that even your players are kind of like, 75%ing their way through the screens and the cuts. I think we saw that in Charlotte with Steve Clifford kind of running the same spread pick and roll. And now he evolved, took a lot more threes after his first year on the job there. But I just think, like, and I think we saw it for sure in Portland, where that post LaMarcus year one, they kind of caught everyone with this beautiful flowing offense and the flare screens over here. And the league sort of gradually were like, all right, we get this now. And Portland this year is finally saying, we're going to have some new wrinkles. We're going to have to try some new stuff. I think that there's that push and pull of continuity, which gets at the lineup question you're asking. I think that's a very hard question for teams to answer.
Yeah. And look, and to that point, I don't worry. I mean, if anything, Brett Brown is a guy who's predisposed to trying. I mean, he errs on the side of experimentation. And let's mix it up. I mean, he is sort of, in a beautiful way, the ADD of coaches, right? Like, I mean, I think that, they have principles, but I don't worry about Brett Brown running the same stuff for, you know, two straight seasons, much less two straight months. I mean, he's just, you know, it's funny. I was talking to another coach who really admires him. It's just like, there are times you look up at Philadelphia and you're like, what the hell are you doing, you crazy man? And then it works. And you're like, all right. Like,
well, you know why?
It's fun. Like, yeah.
I think Brett Brown, I think I would do a lot of things for Brett Brown. Like, if Brett, he just is so engaging and he's got that weird Aussie Maine accent and he's positive all the time. If Brett Brown was like, Zach, let's rob a bank tonight. I'm going to psych us up. Here's the plan. Like, Joel's going to be the getaway driver. Like, we're going to rob this bank. I know you have a nice career, a good family, but, like, I've planned it out. The score is going to be really big. Like, I think I'd be like, I'm in. Let's do it, Brett Brown. I think I would do it. Like, he's just such his positive spirit.
And then we're all going to move to Tasmania where they won't extradite us. Yes. I mean, that would be the solution. Yeah. I'm a huge Brett Brown fan, but it is funny because I am of the tack, like, hey, you know, it's a very empirical way to think, like, 21.4 net rating. How on earth do you give that up? And, But I also admire the boldness. And look, they're going to need Fultz. I mean, at the end of the day, they're going to need Fultz to be Fultzy if this is going to happen. I mean, they're competing against, you know, especially in Boston, a really powerful adversary in that conference. I mean, they're going, if they want this to be the reign of the Sixers in the 2020s, that's what they're going to need. They're going to need Fultz. So why not now? And by the way, if it doesn't work, hey, JJ Redick's right there.
If it fails,
I mean, there are modifications you can make, and they have so much versatility, right? Like Simmons can be whatever you want him to be. I mean, literally 1 through 5. So it's just, you can mix, there are enough colors on the palette that you can really just kind of do whatever you want. So I've gone from in the last 2 weeks since I was there and kind of learned about it. It's like, oh God, are you kidding me? To, okay. All right. And also being reminded that it's October. Again, I mean, this thing will metastasize and these lineups will metastasize 40 times between now and April 14th.
We want to hear an interesting Sixer stat.
Yeah.
That I think gets at this pick and roll thing. Like, let's have a more dynamic pick and roll ball handler. 29th in corner threes attempted last year. That surprised me, considering how many threes Brett Brown wants to take. I think they were 12th overall in, like, total three-point rate overall. They just couldn't generate corner threes, and I think
You're not sucking teams into the middle.
Yeah, one of the easiest ways to do
it. There's a reason high pick and roll is high pick and roll.
Yeah,
right?
I think that's the kind of number they have in mind when they paint the corners in the practice facility red and say, please stand there, run there, and have a dynamic, slashing ball handler in the starting lineup. Getting tickets online can be very complicated. I used to get stressed out about it when I had visitors come and I would try to get the Knicks tickets. Oh my gosh, there's a million secondary market websites that I forget to check that one. Am I getting ripped off because I didn't check those two? All of a sudden an hour has gone by. SeatGeek solves all those problems for you. It pulls millions of tickets from all of the secondary market into one place so you can easily find seats at a good price. It has a super user-friendly, easy to use, color-coded system, green dots for good deals, red dots for bad deals, very easy to see where the seat is in the arena, if it's obstructed view, if it's clear where it is, all that stuff is just boom, 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 click, 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 you're done. Every purchase is fully guaranteed, so you can shop for tickets on SeatGeek with confidence. It can do sporting events, the NFL season is underway, NBA season starting soon, comedy shows, Broadway plays, they help me get tickets to Hamilton. Best of all, my listeners get $20 off their first SeatGeek purchase. All you have to do, download the SeatGeek app, enter promo code LOW, L-O-W-E, that's my last name, the name of this podcast, promo code LOW, boom, $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase. SeatGeek, life's an event, and we have the tickets. Kevin Arnovitz, let's do at least one more off your list real quickly. Give me another one of your confusing teams for the season. This will be your third or fourth, I can't remember.
Okay, this is my fourth. The New Orleans Pelicans.
On my list, too. Boom. Love it.
Oh, awesome. Okay. You know, I mean, I don't have any, I don't think I have any profound questions here. I mean, obviously, last season, Cousins goes down, and they proceed to go 20-8, essentially, in the last 28 games of the season. That wasn't their record without, I mean, they lost a couple right off the bat and then, you know, caught fire. They sweep Portland. You know, you change identities on a dime. They become razor fast. They actually also have like the fifth best defense in the league, which runs counter to, hey, we go smaller. You know, AD's allergy to playing the five is cured, at least ostensibly. Rajon Rondo, it turns out, is exactly what you need to elevate a lottery team to the conference semifinals. Who knew? Holiday stays, Drew stays healthy, and Mirotić is this wonderful additive. And, okay, so we now believe this is the fourth-best team in the West. And then I look at it, and, you know, Rondo's gone, and I never thought I'd say in 2018, oh, Rondo, they're going to really miss Rondo. But
he was good.
You know, you've got Elfert.
He was good.
For them, he was good. And, you know, you're bringing in Elfert Payton, who, you know, at this point is just trying to restore a career. I always liked him defensively early in his career, and the numbers sort of bore that out. But, you know, I didn't see a lot in the last year in Orlando, I don't think he's a guy who does anything particularly well except look like the kind of point guard, you know, who should be competing in the modern NBA. So are you going to run Peyton, Holiday, Moore, Mirotić, and Davis out there? And, wow. And then, you know, you start looking at the rotation. And again, I know I have a rule. Like, I'm not going to judge a team based on its seventh and eighth guys. But, you know, I like Randall. I actually like Darius Morris. I like him for them.
Morris, you know, or Miller?
Oh, did I say Miller? I mean, I've been at Miller. I'm sorry.
I believe both are on their roster right now.
You know, and then, okay, so what are you going to do now? Now it's, you know, Solomon Hill and either Ian Clark or Jared Jack, whichever you trust more. Boy, that's a little thin. Wait, we're talking about this team as sort of a playoff lock, are we? Because, wow, it looks like Anthony Davis and a lot of question marks. And because, you know, we hope Goose stays healthy, and he looks great. But then you come back to the idea that you have one of the three best basketball players in the world. And, it was funny. In the MVP race, he was sort of this distant third. And we didn't just talk about the magnitude of his season and what he was able to do the last couple of months. And this is a superstar league, and generally speaking, if you have one of the three best players in the world, and even a modicum of support, you know, a good backcourt mate, like, you're going to be at, I mean, there's a floor there. And if Davis is healthy, there's a floor there. But I look at the composition. I'm not totally bought in, but then I go back to him. I go back to what they did. I go back to the things I like about Holiday and Mirotić. The fact that I think Moore is very serviceable in that position. It's hard for me to come up with a prognosis.
Well, I mean, if we simplify, they're on my list too, so, you know, I did a lot of stuff on them. If you simplify it to its most basic terms, it's rare to find a great NBA team or a lock 50-win NBA team in 2018 where three of the team's four best players are big men. That's a roster construction that generally does not lead you to great confidence in the team, and that's Davis, Mirotić, and Randle, who I think are three of their four best players, along with Drew Holiday, obviously. Holiday. And that just – all the guys you just named on the perimeter that are not Drew Holiday are going to determine whether this team is an easy playoff team. I have them penciled in as a playoff team now, but I'm nervous about it as you are, or something more or something less. And to – like, Etuan Moore is what he is. Very good – very solid NBA player. Will shoot nicely from three, get you 8-9 points a game, play hard on defense. Like, he's just not going to really – do anything more than that or take you to any place more exciting than that. Darius Miller, like, can dribble once now, which is progress. Like, he can pump fake dribble and then take a long two. Sometimes he dribbles twice. Like, if he can dribble twice more often and then make a pass, that gets interesting. Don't know that it's going to happen. They like Frank Jackson. To me, Peyton is the most important variable on their team. I'm not out, but I've never been a fan. I think all his defense, he's very Rondo-esque in that all of his alleged defensive acumen is fake because he runs around and gets steals every now and then, but he's just running around having no attention to the scheme or where he should be. Can't shoot at all. And, you know, Rondo made up for that last year with a little better catch-and-shoot numbers. And also, like, he's a genius passer. He's not just a good passer. He is a genius, creative passer. Elfrid Payton's just a good passer. He's not a genius passer. And so that, I just get a little uneasy with the burden on him. Now, it's very easy to say, okay, just get him out of the lineup and play Drew Holiday a point. And they can do that. I'm comfortable with that. They've never been super comfortable with Drew as a point guard, but I like, you know, a lineup like Drew Holiday, Etuan Moore, Miller, Mirotić, and Davis, five out and let Davis just rampage.
Yeah, I would do that.
Holiday, Moore, Solomon Hill, Mirotić, and Davis. And that gets at the point of, like, they ran into this in the regular season and then very dramatically in the playoffs. Like, when they get two of their non-shooters on the floor at the same time, because their non-shooters are really non-shooters, everything starts to fall apart. And you throw in Randle, who just decided he wasn't going to shoot jumpers really anymore last year to his benefit. And that's a third non-shooter who's going to play a lot. They got to be careful with that. So it does come back to AD, and it's hard to bet against AD, but they're a team that makes me a little nervous.
Defensively, you know, it looked really good. And look, that is half your grade. This is truly, you know, it's funny. I'm sitting here, I have them fourth. This might be, after all said and done, you know, just kind of, we've contorted ourselves the last 5 minutes. This might be my most confusing team. I just don't know how to praise them.
They were a must on my list. They were the first team I thought of.
Wow. Oh, good. Then, you know, we think like,
part of it is that, again, anytime there's a late season change, like DeMarcus getting hurt, and then, you know, it's really tempting and really easy to look at what happened in the first round between Portland and New Orleans. And for both of those teams, ascribe too much importance to four games. That said, and all the analytics and all the sample size and all that stuff says that you should not do that, that that is an empirical trap that you're going to fall in. That said, that sweep, for both teams raised red flags for the Blazers and whatever the opposite of red flags is for the Pelicans. It's hard for me to just say those four games are the average sweep. I don't think it was the average sweep in terms of what it told us about those teams. But it's hard to evaluate these sort of like stretch run teams and playoff, you know, random matchup that is favorable to you and you get a sweep team. There's that at work. at work too with the Pelicans. All right, before we go, we're not going to do them in detail, but who was the other team we didn't get to on your list?
Chicago.
Not on my list.
Not in the sense that I think they're going to, they could win a lot of games or not win a lot of games. I just going into the season, I there's not one team I know less about than the Bulls, especially with Markkanen out. It makes it even harder. Just the introduction of Jabari, projecting Chris Dunn, still figuring out who Zach LaVine is as a player. To what extent is he efficient? He's one of the highest usage guys. He's going to be, again, one of the highest usage guys in the league. And it's like, I still don't feel like, on that list of high usage guys, I still don't know exactly who he is. His athleticism, sort of contradicts what we think he should be defensively, and maybe the athleticism is vertical and not lateral. I like the direction the franchise is moving. I just don't know what it is.
I just think they're going to be bad, and so that was not confusing.
Yeah, they're going to be bad. I what flavor of bad?
And the one team we didn't get to on my list is Utah. And that
why are they confusing to you?
I was going to say that will surprise people for the same thing I just said about the Pelicans. So Utah finished last season 29-6 in their last 35 games. And I think there is a tendency to just say, that's the Jazz. That's what the Jazz are. The Jazz, Chris Herring, the great Chris Herring wrote, they may be the second best team in the West, if not the league. I can't remember exactly what, I think just the West. I'm not sure, and let me say that again clearly for the loony Jazz fans, because the Jazz fans are the looniest Jazz fans are the looniest loons in the loon league.
You think they're top in the loon?
Oh, there's nothing like crazy Jazz fans. Crazy Jazz fans.
No, I know you go in there and it's loud and everything, but in terms of just irrational behavior?
Well, they just bring everything to the table. They bring, no one pays attention to us, which they will say to you, and I'm just saying this is the 1% of super crazies. They will say, you can release a Jazz column, and that day they will be tweeting at you, ESPN never covers the Jazz. Do I have ESPN over? You could be in Utah for a week, and they'll be like, you've never covered the Jazz. No one covers the Jazz. I'm not sure, which means literally I'm not sure that I'm right or I'm wrong. That, what did they win last year? 50? 48?
I'd have to bring it up.
It doesn't matter. Whatever that number is.
Everyone in the West won 47 games. I don't know.
I'm not sure that they're just automatically better than that this year. I'm not sure that the 29-6 stretch, which included some good wins, some fake good wins, like a blowout against the Warriors where they didn't play any of their guys, and two wins against the Wolves without Jimmy Butler, who were terrible. I'm not sure that that is what the Jazz are. And maybe they are, let's see, last year they won
48.
Maybe they're, I'm not sure that they're not just a 48 or 49 or even 50 win team. I'm not ready to say, okay, they're young. They had a star rookie who's going to get better, and they have, they are maybe as deep in wings as maybe deeper than any team in the league in wings, which is bodes well for your ability to win in the modern NBA. Here's a stat. So before January 24th, this stat just blows me away. Before January 24th, here were their numbers with Rubio, Favors, and Gobert on the floor at the same time. 90 points per possession, 106 allowed. Minus 16. Ooh. Minus 16. After January 24th, 113 scored, 95 allowed. You would be hard-pressed to find any big minutes trio that had that kind of turnaround in the same season in the entire history of the league. That is insane. It's insane. Rubio shot 44.
What do we attribute the reversal to? Who are sort of the parts 4 and 5 who might have influenced?
Well,
that?
Rubio caught fire.
O'Neal and
yeah, Rubio caught fire. Their small ball lineup, once they got Crowder, Rubio, Mitchell, Ingles, Crowder, Gobert lit the league on fire. And
I love that lineup.
And I do think there was some legitimate sort of chemistry and identity and system comfort progress that was made. Gobert came back healthy and looked like an absolute monster. Favors was healthier than he had been in years and hopefully still is. I think the Jazz are really good. If you told me the Jazz finished third in the West, not a surprise at all. I'll probably pick them to finish third in the West. If you told me that, Mitchell, and by the way, this applies to Jason Tatum too. If you told me that Mitchell and Tatum are, 5% worse than they were last year as standout rookies. Wouldn't shock me. That happens sometimes. They were unbelievable as rookies. Shouldn't necessarily, again, assume a linear jump for them. So they're not confusing. I think the Jazz are really good. I don't know what that translates to in terms of win totals. That's all.
Yeah, I'm having trouble with like 2 through 7 in the West. I really am.
That's an evergreen. That's an evergreen concern at this point.
Yeah, no, I mean, and I have Jazz too right now. I'm one of those bullish Jazz people. But
over
again,
Houston,
I also think over Houston, but who have is a near third. You know, I mean, with Houston, I worry about age. I worry about health. I think they may miss a couple of those guys. Like, is that team really the seventh best defense in the league again this year? I don't know. Maybe.
I'm weirdly unworried
about
the Rockets.
No, I'm not worried. I don't know that they were like. I mean, I think it was understated. It was the Warriors and the Rockets last year, and by January we sort of had that was congealed, and that was the conference, and it was and then it was like sort of the upper middle class, and then you know the dregs, and I just don't know that the separation between the Rockets and 3, 4, and 5 is as distinct this year.
That's fair. That's fair. All right, Kevin Arnovitz, it's always a pleasure to have you on. So we got to be on the lookout for this Philly piece ASAP in the magazine. What else is happening? Anything else to pump up?
What else is happening? It's a really fun time of year where you get to call, you know, people in the league and say, hey, you know, like, what's interesting? It's kind of the discovery period, and I really enjoy the discovery period. I mean, these stories don't manufacture themselves. You get assignments, but part of it's just finding like what's fun, like what are the collective obsessions of the league this year, you know? And that's sort of the discovery period right now, and so we will see. The next time we speak, I suspect there will be more stuff.
Well, I think we're going to both be at the Clippers opener on October 17th. I think it's home, right? Is it not home?
It's not. Yeah, it's home. I mean, home Denver and home OKC.
Yeah, it's a great first week of games. LeBron circus is out of town. There'll be literally 25% as many media there for Clippers. Two good Western Conference games: Clippers Thunder, Clippers Nuggets. Those are fun games. I'm excited for those games.
So I will see you out here then.
Los Angeles is beautiful. It's going to be very nice there. All right, Kevin, thanks for everything. We'll look for your Philly feature, and we will see you in Staples Center in 13 days, my friend.
You got it.
The Low Post is presented by Goodyear. Discover the possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.